I just want to mention, first of all, I don't know whether you're interested, you would be interested in this retreat or not, but we just found out about it in the course of the last week. And Greg and I decided that we'd like to make it. It's during the week of 17th of February to the 19th. And it's at the Jesuit Retreat House at Pickering in Manresa. Eugene Gendlin's book, I'll leave it here if you want to look at it. But the interesting thing about it, it's related to this course, and that's why I'm mentioning it to you. I also gave a notice of this just to Sister Kathleen Flynn, who's teaching a spirituality course right next door here. And she said she's going to mention it to her students as well. But the interesting thing about this is that Lonergan gave me a copy of Gendlin's book, Focusing, many years ago, and he said that the exercises that Gendlin puts you through are very closely related to what I was writing about in terms of psychic conversion. And my way of coming to psychic conversion was through dream analysis, but I had always said that there are other ways of doing it. And Gendlin is opening up a whole other way of coming into contact with the depths of feeling and situated feeling, felt sense is his term, or in one of his earlier books, felt meaning. I used one of his earlier books in my dissertation. So if you want to look at the book, I'll just leave it here. But Jane Galvin has been doing retreats and counseling and spiritual direction based on Gendlin's work for a long time. Not only did Lonergan like Gendlin, Gendlin has also verbally expressed a great admiration for Lonergan's work. Now, I called Jane today and I spoke to her, and she said, by all means, mention it in your class if you want. But she said, be sure you emphasize that. She said, what I'm doing is practical. I said it was a course on Lonergan. And she said, I'm not in that league. And I said, well, you know, I didn't want to say Lonergan's practical too. It's all about self-appropriation. But what Jane is doing and what Gendlin is doing is, it's a set of exercises that are geared towards an appropriation of the first level, where the imperative is be attentive. And I think focus, Gendlin's focusing is another way of talking about being attentive, and especially being attentive to your existential state in concrete situations. So she runs these retreats, and she helps people learn these techniques of focusing based on Gendlin's work. I called the retreat house. She told me to call the retreat house and ask if there's a student rate. And I called and I got an answering machine, so I left the question as to whether there is a student rate for the retreat. I haven't heard back yet, but if there is, I will let you know next week if anybody is interested in going. It's the 17th, Tuesday night, 7 p.m. with registration. The first session is 7:30, and it goes until after lunch on the 19th. There are five meals included in it. So far, Greg and I are the only two enrolled, and we're trying to get at least five. So if you've got any interest in it, you can either let one of us know, or the phone number's on there, and you can call and just indicate that you're interested. There's no, you don't have to put any money down to get there. And to get there, the train, the GO train to Pickering is one way. You can take it from Union Station, and then it's a short cab ride from train station to the retreat house. So I am checking on student rates, or if you drive, it's just down to 401 to Pickering on the Liverpool Road north. Okay, so that's my announcement. I do recommend it, and I recommend Gendlin's book and his work. It's very sound, extremely sound, and it'll be intimately related to what he's doing to a lot of the stuff that we're going to be talking about today, because we're into the whole area of human development and the complexities of human. So, with that, we move to the second part of chapter 15. Everybody got the notes on the second part of chapter 15? So the remainder of chapter 15, this would be sections 6 and 7. Those sections are concerned with development and genetic method. The section on development, I divide into three parts. These are not Lonergan's divisions. First of all, there are principles of development. Secondly, a definition of development, and thirdly, examples of development. Development will require, to study development, will require a new set of heuristic structures, namely genetic heuristic structures. So far, remember now, metaphysics is the conception, affirmation, and implementation of an integral heuristic structure. That is to say, it will pull together all of the heuristic structures that are used for the study of proportional being. So up to this point in the book, we have seen two, namely classical and statistical. And here he's introducing a third heuristic structure, genetic, for the study of development. Classical, things and their relations to one another. Statistical, the probabilities of coincidental departures from regularities, from regular schemes of recurrence. Genetic, development. Development in conjugate forms. Development is something that, as he will argue, development in the conjugate forms that implicitly define what anything is at any point in its development. So there's development in conjugate forms. Okay, so he presents then seven principles of development. First, the principle of emergence. And in many senses, this is already familiar. As we go through these principles of development today, in the back of your mind, think in terms of, is there something in your own life right now? This is not a sensitivity session. You don't have to reveal what it is, but is there an area of development that is important? Habit. Something that you want to develop in your own life in terms of a habit or something like that. And then use that as a reference point for these principles. But at any rate, the first is the principle of emergence. It's already familiar in a general sense. Otherwise, coincidental manifolds of lower conjugate acts invite the higher integration effected by higher conjugate forms. Now, it's familiar in the examples that he's already given, because they're the ones that we've seen in the discussion of emergent probability, in the discussion of things, and in the discussion, of again last week, of genera and species in the context of metaphysics. Chemical elements and compounds are higher integrations of otherwise coincidental manifolds of subatomic events. Organisms, living things, are higher integrations of otherwise coincidental manifolds of chemical processes. Sensitive consciousness is a higher integration of otherwise coincidental manifolds of changes in neural tissues. Accumulating insights are higher integrations of otherwise coincidental manifolds of images or data. So that's in that whole broad sweep of emergent probability, universal process. But besides these, other examples, and the ones that are much more important for the study of the development of things, could be given that highlight more properly development within unity's identities holds, and especially within human persons. The emergence of higher viewpoints. Higher viewpoints emerge out of a coincidental manifold of acts that don't fit into previous schemes, like Kuhn's paradigm shifts and so on. The emergence of new paradigms in the intellectual order. The emergence of new habits in personal living. How do they emerge? Well, they emerge out of random acts. Okay, but random acts over a while become regular. The regularity is introduced and habits emerge. The emergence of new feelings, a lot of which is what genuine is all about, getting in touch with the feelings that are blocking development, naming them, standing back from them and naming them and finding a way to negotiate a shift, a bodily shift, a shift in the sensed meaning, the felt sense of things, the emergence of new feelings. Next is the principle of correspondence, which is correlative to the principle of emergence. Emergence is that the otherwise coincidental manifolds invite higher integration. Higher integration is limited and corresponds to what you've got to work with. So the correspondence is correlative to emergence. Significantly different underlying manifolds, which you've got to work with, require different higher integrations. So the chemical elements differ by atomic numbers and atomic weights. These differences are grounded in the underlying manifold. Different aggregates of chemical processes involve different organisms. Neural events in the eye and in the ear call forth different conscious experiences. Seeing is very different from hearing. That's grounded in the underlying difference of the neural manifolds. The neural manifolds for the eye are very different from those for the ear. So different events at those lower levels, or more basic levels, or whatever term you want to use for them, are give rise to different integrations at a psychic level. Seeing and hearing, very different, because there are different neural events that feed up to them. Different data will lead to different theories. So those are his examples. The principle of correspondence enjoys a measure of flexibility. So nothing is fixed on permanent rails, as it were, because within limits, the same higher integration can systematize differing manifolds. And he gives some examples of this. The same kind of atom can have subatomic components at different energy levels. The same kind of organism, whether it's a plant or an animal or a human being, admits differences of size, shape, weight. Similarities of character and temperament are compatible, probably enough, with neural differences. And the same theory can be reached from different data. So it's not as though this is all fixed and determinate. But the limits still do exist, and to transgress them or to overlook them, as in the development of habits, is to eliminate the higher integration. In other words, to overlook it in the development of habits would be, well, if you don't practice, if you're trying to learn a musical instrument, if you don't practice, you're not going to develop the habit. There's a certain amount of what has to be done, piano, violin, you name it. You've got to do this trial and error stuff before the habit, before it becomes habitual. So to transgress the limits, the higher integration won't emerge if you don't pay attention to the underlying manifold, which is all of these acts that you've got to do, making a lot of mistakes and everything else, before you get it right, so that the habits can emerge. Thirdly, the principle of finality. The underlying manifold is an upwardly but indeterminately directed dynamism towards ever fuller realization of being. This is an important thing, I think, in our own development. We can talk about it in more in language that perhaps is more spiritual, that there is this thirst, this restlessness, okay, that we all experience, an upwardly but indeterminately directed dynamism toward an ever fuller realization of being. That's part of what we experience, right? He puts it in supremely sophisticated philosophical language, but it's Augustine's restlessness. Our hearts are restless until they rest in God. That's an upwardly but indeterminately directed dynamism, although Augustine saw that it was headed to God, but toward ever fuller realization of being. It's a philosophic way of naming the same restlessness that Augustine was talking about. Every limitation is a barrier to be transcended in some way. Every limitation towards the development, for instance, of our full humanity is a barrier to be transcended. We want to transcend those limitations. But we can distinguish between static and dynamic higher integrations, and particularly in the living realm, a lot of the higher integrations are static. They stay where they are. A higher integration is static when it dominates the lower manifold with complete success and thereby brings about a notable imperviousness to change. This can also happen, of course, in individual living, that our habits can become so rigid and so fixed, or our ways of thinking or our ways of feeling, they can become so fixed that they dominate, and nothing can get in there to mix it up, all right? So that coincidental acts can give rise to perhaps new feelings, new habits, new thoughts, whatever. On the social realm, an authoritarian government, a totalitarian government, will so fix the schemes that it's almost impossible for new schemes to emerge. They try to have so much control over what happens. In the United States now, the news is being filtered, as we all know, so that people don't even have a chance to know what's going on that would help change some of the schemes that are operative in the government. That's not all of the U.S. is happening here, too, but it's much more obvious, more serious there. So the static that they're attempting to fix dominate the lower manifold of the questions that people would raise in that kind of instance. So to bring about a notable imperviousness to change. So the inert gases, well, here he's talking about a sub-living kind of thing, but you could refer to some some people in some societies as being about as flexible as an inert gas, you know. The inert gases can lock coincidental manifolds of subatomic events in remarkably permanent routines. It's just, it's Cardinal Ottaviani in the church sent their edam. It's always the same. There are no changes, you know. And the church in the pre-Vatican II period, and some would say in the post-Vatican period, has gotten into this thing, trying so to control everything that the questions that would give rise to changes in certain forms of living are not allowed to emerge and to be discussed. And it's certainly, the case with the Latin Sempertia. That's what we get. On the other hand, the higher integration is dynamic when it's not content to systematize the underlying manifold, but keeps adding to it, modifying it, until by the principle of correspondence, the existing integration is eliminated, and by the principle of emergence, a new integration is introduced. So, next, then, there's the principle of development itself. The principle of development indicates that there will be the linked sequence of dynamic higher integration. An initial coincidental manifold is systematized and modified by a higher integration so as to call forth a second. The second leads to a third, the third to a fourth, and so on, until the possibilities of development along a given line are exhausted and the relative stability and maturity is reached. Lonergan does some work in his own writing, but he had not yet read Piaget by the time he wrote Insight, but in the lectures in education, there's a great deal of reliance on Piaget throughout the lectures and then a whole lecture on Piaget. But this is what Piaget is talking about. An initial coincidental manifold in an infant is systematized at a certain level, modified by a higher integration, calls forth a second as the infant does more exploring and so on and so forth. The second leads to a third, the third to a fourth. The infant, the child becomes capable of different kinds of cognitive operations. It's all the study of precisely this kind of linked sequence, the linked sequence of higher integrations and cognitive development. The fifth principle is the principle of increasing explanatory differentiation. In other words, if you want to know what makes a human being a fully alive human subject, you study, you don't start with studying the infant. It doesn't mean that the infant is not a human person. It doesn't mean that at all. But it means rather, if you want to know what the potential is, you don't stick there. You look at what has been developed. Our understanding of any genera and species is in terms not of the initial and generic integrations in the initial manifold, even though, however enjoyable that may be, watching a child develop or watching a puppy develop or a pet. It's a wonderful, it's a delightful thing. But you really know what the potential is when you see an organism, an animal, a human being that has developed its potential. And that gives you the explanation of where these other developments are heading, the initial and the intermediate developments. So what's important then are what's generated in the process from the initial stages, in and through the process of development. And that's what tells you what it's possible to be. And when we feel ourselves called out of ourselves to higher, whether it be to higher sanctity or to higher intellectual achievements, or whatever, we always look to those people in whom the developments from the initial stages through the process of development are really calling us forth to the fullness of what is possible for human beings to achieve. And then there are two principles of flexibility, the sixth and the seventh principles, the minor flexibility, namely the same ultimate goal can be reached by different routes. There's the famous set of experiments in biology with sea urchins. A normal sea urchin can result from an embryo that was subjected to distorting pressures. Now, whether the experiments actually introduced the distortions or whether it was just the life environment of the embryo, I'm not sure, but they found that things can happen in the course of development to compensate for deficiencies at the beginning. Psychic health can be due to the untutored spontaneity of someone who grows up in a relatively innocent environment, but who of us today particularly is privy to that kind of privilege. Or to the ministrations of the psychiatrist or whatever. There's a way of reaching it, even though you might have a lot to battle against. The same science can be taught successfully in accord with different methods. The same discovery can be made in different manners, and so on and so forth. And then a principle of major flexibility. We find in our own lives that the ultimate objective, as we've defined it, can shift. It can change. We can redefine it. We can modify it. Adaptation, sublimation, shift from one problem to another. The whole debate between Freud and Jung on psychic energy and where it's headed is an illustration of this. For Freud, psychic energy is all aboriginally sexual, and any directedness of psychic energy towards anything other than sexual objects is a matter of displacement. For Jung, psychic energy is originally undifferentiated, and it can be helpfully, not displaced, not by way of displacement, but helpfully directed in a number of different ways. Among which there must be some kind of coming to grips with the sexual, but that is not the underlying thing. And the energy, the psychic energy, at the level of psychic response, and so on, conations, emotions, feelings, memories, and all of that sort of thing, it's capable of being legitimately, not by way of displacement, but legitimately directed to art, culture, music, and we don't have to understand those to intellectual pursuits, to religion. We don't have to understand those as simply displacements of an aboriginal sexual energy. And so for Jung, there is present. I have a number of problems with some things in Jung, but this I'm completely in agreement with. There's the possibility of multiple authentic ways of human beings developing, and a number of different objectives for the source of that development, depending on what their skills are, their talents, what they're called to, what their abilities are, and so on. And you don't have to say that it's all a displacement of something that is far more primordial than that. Important in human living, but nowhere near, in my estimation, the significance that Freud would attach to it. So Jung would be a person whose psychology does acknowledge the major flexibility, where ultimate objectives can shift, and not necessarily by way of displacement, but simply by way even of free decision. You can decide, a person can decide to devote herself to music. That's a legitimate autonomous decision. It doesn't have to be reduced to she's displacing sexual energy. It doesn't work that way. It's a legitimate thing to do. Okay, so then the rest of number 8 there is simply a filling out of the principle of nature flexibility. So I don't think I need to. Is that any issues that people want to ask at this point? Okay. So development then is defined, next is the definition, as a flexible linked sequence of dynamic and increasingly differentiated higher integrations that meet the tension of successively transformed underlying manifolds through successive applications of the principles of correspondence and emergence. So that's the lengthy definition, but that's the definition that he gives. And then the next thing that he does is move into a number of examples of development, organic, psychic, and intellectual. The initial instance is organic, the division of the cell, where there is growth, as opposed to reproduction. The cell can split off and there can be reproduction. But here he's talking about the division of the cell, giving rise to growth within the same unity identity whole. Growth is an increase in differentiation, organic development, organic differentiation of limbs, muscles, well, in animals and human beings, it would be limbs and muscles and all of that sort of thing. Psychic development is a sequence of increasingly complex forms of sensitive consciousness, increasingly refined patterns of responding affectively, responding sensitively, responding with memory, being able to call upon it an increasingly rich store of emotional possibilities. And this is, it's found in animals, and in some animals there's a much greater flexibility than others for the development of different sensitive responses. But it is most richly diverse and highly integrated in the human person, at least in the human person, in many instances, of course. You can say that, that a lot of animals are safer to be around than some human beings in terms of the development of their sensitive consciousness and their ability to respond in some ways. But it is, nonetheless, there are high integrations of sensitive consciousness in human beings in terms of art, culture, music, and so on that we don't find in the elements. Just as in an animal, not in a plant, there are realized the fullest potentialities of organic diversity. Animal bodies are far more diversified, far more differentiated, and a sophisticated structure than they find in a plant. Neural development is the underlying manifold for psychic development. So the neural development in an animal and the neural development in a human being provides the underlying manifold. But psychic development is not just neural tissues, neural configurations, neural events. One a clear instance of this, both psychic and intellectual, think of Stephen Hawking. Okay? If psychic and intellectual development were reduced to neural events, neural tissues, neural configurations, the man would not have written a brief history of time. You've got a brilliant mind and a body that's falling apart. And you've got a brilliant psyche that is presenting the images. You've got a psyche that's quickly producing the images for the theories that he's producing. These cannot be reduced to neural tissues, neural configurations, neural events, but rather a sequence of increasingly differentiated and integrated sets of capacities for perceptiveness, for aggressive or affective response, for memory, for imaginative projects, for skillfully and economically executed performance. The psyche has a flexibility vis-a-vis the underlying neural manifold. And that these two, what I mean by they, there I mean the neural and the psychic, that they're different can also be seen. I don't think it's necessarily most clearly seen in the case of multiple personality. I think also the geniuses like Hawking, a person like Helen Keller, where the neural configurations didn't offer her much to deal with, but the psyche took over, and she was able to live a life of continuous learning throughout her life. And so there is a difference here. There's a certain flexibility. But in the case of multiple personality, the three faces of Eve and that sort of thing, where a single individual, single unity identity whole, exhibits at different times quite different psychic integrations, different integrations of different perceptive, associative, emotive, cognitive, operative characteristics. Just as the single cell is so integrated as to head towards a duplication of its dynamic patterns and a consequent division, so in a fashion not altogether different, the higher integration of sensitive consciousness can so interact with its neural basis as to generate different and incompatible integrations. And this would be the way in which Lonergan would therefore explain metaphysically, or at least approach an explanation of something like the characteristics of the multiple personality. And the greatest diversities of sensitive consciousness, of perceptiveness, of imaginative power, nuanced affects, acquired skills, occur in the human person. Depth psychology throws a great deal of light on this subject, and Lonergan believes that his definition of development supplies a single scheme that unites Freud's wish fulfillment and sublimation and Jung's archetypal symbol. And this is a quote from page 482. The unconscious neural basis, and that's what the unconscious would be. The psyche is consciousness, it's sensitive consciousness of its beginnings. The neural basis is unconscious. That neither means nor wishes in the proper senses of those terms, because meaning and wishing are conscious activities. But what is present in that neural basis is the upwardly directed dynamism of finality, the passionateness of being, the tidal movement. There's other languages that he's used for this in other contexts in some of his later writings. Moving towards ever higher, ever fuller realization, first of all, on the proximate sensitive level, and secondly, beyond the limitations of the sensitive level, on higher artistic, dramatic, philosophic, cultural, and religious levels. Now, that is a statement that's completely compatible with Jung on energy as psychic. It's headed towards fuller realizations on all of those levels. And it's capable of being shifted into any of those levels: art, culture, philosophy, music, religion. Hence, insight into dream symbols and associated images and affects reveals to the psychologist a grasp of the anticipations and virtualities of higher activities imminent in the underlying unconscious manifold. My view of that statement is that it's far more compatible with Jung's understanding of dreams than it is with Freud. Freud's understanding of dreams is always to go back. Dreams are a symptom of something that goes back, while Ricoeur says that the movement ever backwards for Freud. And for Jung, the meaning of many dreams, what Binswanger calls the dreams of the morning, the meaning is forward. The dream is an anticipation of the subject in his or her daily life, moving forward, not necessarily going backward, perhaps the dialectical tension of the two. So I think that he's really coming down much more strongly here with Jung than he might realize in this particular example. Freud's superego, Lonergan explains in a similar way, as both an anticipation and a caricature of the judgments of rational consciousness and the conduct of a rational being. I'm not sure Freud would agree with that. I think Jung would say that that's what Freud's superego is, but I don't think Freud would agree that that's what it is. The censor is a law governing the interrelations between successive levels of integration. Elements of the manifold either can or cannot enter the integration. Analysis, this is psychological analysis now, is engaged in enlarging a person's potentialities for integration. And resistance, on the part of any of us, and we all can experience resistance at times to growth, is a reflection of the present integration twisting what it can assimilate and circumventing what it cannot. In a retreat, if you're a director, I found as a director in a retreat, if you find levels of resistance, it's precisely there the grace is at work. What are people resisting? What is it that they don't want to fix? Where are the shifts and the dodges coming? Resistance, as he puts it here again, a reflection of the present integration of my life, twisting what it can assimilate and circumventing what it can't assimilate. And sometimes we can't assimilate yet, but gotta wait, patience. Regarding the central role of sexual development highlighted by Freud, from Lonergan's perspective, sexual development will move in a person's life from the generic to the specific. It will divide into stages imposed by somatic development. Oh, that's obvious. It's to all of us. The success of higher integrations must meet increasingly determinate neural demands, and to do so involves attending to ever larger fields of data on these demands. So this responsibility that is placed on us for our own sexual development as we grow, attending to ever larger fields of data, negotiating the neural demands, finding, I would add here, ever more nuanced ways of negotiating them in the context of committed interpersonal relations. All of that fits into the sexual development of the person. And then finally, for now, intellectual development. He'll go on in chapter 18 to speak of moral development, and in chapter 20 of religious development. But intellectual development, for up to this point, is the principal illustration of the notion of development. That's the one that, at least within the context of this book, we can get a hold of quite clearly. Namely, an otherwise coincidental manifold of images or data is integrated by insights. The effort to formulate systematically what's grasped by insight, alternatively the effort to act upon it, gives rise to further questions, directs attention to further data, leads to the emergence of further insights, and so the cycle of development begins another turn. Well, that's what he's been studying all through this book. Questions lead to answers, questions lead to answers, and so on and so forth. Okay, can we pause for a few minutes and see whether there are anything, any things that need clarification, Chris?
I I guess, just to clarify here, I'm wondering about the principle of correspondence. And so is it, just to try and wrap my mind around what's going on here, so is it that the higher integration corresponds to these lower coincidental manifolds that, like from these lower coincidental manifolds that invite the systematic intervention that is this higher integration? And that's what the principle of correspondence is trying to capture, is that this higher integration corresponds to the lower coincidental manifolds. And so I was wondering about a grasp of the unconditioned with reflective insight.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a criterion, would it be too much of a leap to say that a criterion for truth then would be that the unconditioned corresponds to the images from which insight emerges?
Often, the answer to your question would be often that is the case, because it's often that you go back to that
mm-hmm.
level to find the evidence that will confirm the hypothesis and give rise to the grasp of the human condition. Is that always the case? I'm not sure. You know, sometimes it may be. I mean, if you're dealing, for instance, with the analytic principle of the isomorphism of knowing and knowing, and you want to say that that's virtually unconditioned, is that a matter? I mean, I want to say that. I would want to say that that's. I can affirm that the thing that we put on
yeah.
the board, that the contents of knowing and the contents of the knower are similar in structure. They must be. But that is really, is that a matter of going back to images, or is that a matter of understanding the definitions of the terms and verifying them in experience? Because they have to be verified in experience, otherwise it's just an analytic proposition, which doesn't necessarily refer to anything real. But an analytic principle, the individual items in that you're talking about in an analytic principle have to be verifiable and affirmed in concrete judgments of fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the concrete judgments of fact, you go back to images for the verification of those. But the analytic principle, which pulls all those concrete judgments of fact together into a higher principle and unites them, I'm not sure that the confirmation of that is directly in a set of images rather than in the understanding of the terms and the building upon those.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long answer to your question, because the short answer is most of the time what you're saying is correct. But you've got at least that instance where the analytic might not be so much a reliance on the images as on the definitions of the terms that you're using and the fact that you've already verified those in concrete judgments of fact. Yes, I do experience something that's experienced.
Uh-huh.
I do understand something that's understood. I do. And,
right.
You know, you've already done that through the self-affirmation of the knower, which did include going back to the images of yourself and the images of these operations and activities and so on. But now that you've done that, do you need to do that all over again to verify the analytic principle that the structure of the knowing and the structure of the knower are isomorphic necessarily? Or can you grasp that without that procedure?
So at the risk of sounding dense,
I just made the whole issue dense, so don't apologize.
If you couldn't verify that, would that mean that the statement of the isomorphism is an implicit definition in the sense that the definition itself relies upon the terms themselves rather than being?
Yeah, it does rely on the terms. I mean, ultimately, if anybody that would question the analytic, you'd have to go back to the individual concrete judgments of fact, in which case you'd have to go back to the whole process and the images and so on. So ultimately, probably, the answer to your question is probably ultimately yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only most of the time, but ultimately yes. But at times when you're, if you're at the point where the analytic principle makes sense without having to do all of that preliminary digging around it, then you can circumvent it. Yes, Jeff.
Professor, you said that our understanding of the development of any species genera should begin at the apex. Gave the example of like a baby versus an adult.
To know what this species is capable of, you start with the more elaborate forms of development.
Can you give an example of something outside of humans?
An animal, you know. I would imagine, I don't know this much about it, but when a litter of schnauzers and a litter of Dobermans are born, they're probably very similar in their behavior. But they will not be in the adult. And it's a psychic difference. There is an organic difference, but what really differentiates them is the psychic difference. There's something different in the psychic wiring properties. But you only know that from the fuller development of these animals. We don't know it from studying them.
And does this have any extra organic implication for stuff outside living things?
Well, development is, notice everything here is living things.
Right.
And he's talking about plants, animals, and living things. So they're all living things. What were you thinking of?
I just wondered if it's just interesting that you begin with the summit of development. So I wonder if that had any extra organic.
I think it's just, no, I don't think so. Well, it has an extra organic in the sense that it's an extremely anti-reductionist position. And it's the similar, it's, could I use a similar, I mean, another kind of analogy, another approach to the thing that's something that I would be familiar with. It's Paul Ricoeur's study of Freud, and he says that Freud gives you an archaeology of the subject. And in other words, that Freud will always understand every, in the limit, he can't really pull it off, but in the limit, Freud wants to understand every phenomenon of human behavior by going back. So all adult performance is a displacement of the aboriginal sexual energy that starts, you know, in pre-Oedipal and so on and so on. It's all explained by going back. And that's what he means by the archaeological. And Jung basically is a teleology of the subject. So Jung will understand human behavior in terms of where it might be headed, what it's headed for. And Ricoeur's position in his book, well, Ricoeur does this all the time, he's one of the supreme mediators of thinkers in conflict, is saying that, well, you know, there's a point to both of them, but the archaeology alone is nowhere near sufficient to give us an explanation of human performance. And it just doesn't do it. He uses Hegel as the explanation, as the person who will explain by going forward. I suggest in one of my comments that it would have been better if had he used Jung, because it would have been in the same field. Both of them depth psychologists, both of them studying the same data, dreams and associations and all of that sort of thing. And Jung's whole emphasis is where is it heading? And that leaves you open for, it leaves the person free to make choices. It opens up the possibility of spirituality and free decision. Within limits, there are always limits because of the underlying manifolds. You can't violate them. I can't refuse to eat and still hope to develop spiritually, because I'm going to develop it anyway while I'm studying. So there are underlying demands that are placed by the underlying manifolds. But there's this openness to flexibility. Does that help at all?
Yes, thanks.
And Jung would be in profound agreement with Lonergan, that to understand what a human being is, well, look at the look at the greatest artists and the greatest thinkers and the greatest mystics, and that tells you what a human being can be. Don't start with the beginning, but start with the fullness of the moment. And then realize that all of this upwardly directed dynamism in us is open to all of that stuff. You know, we can get there. We can have appreciation of music and art. We can be thinkers. We can appreciate philosophy. We can pray. We can meet God. These are all human potentialities. They're all within us. And they're not displacements of some aboriginal, extremely limited object relation.
Well, I'm wondering about fasting in the context of a commitment to a prayer life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's
a choice for praying, and therefore the diminishment.
I didn't mean fasting.
I know you didn't, but I want now that you would take that example, please, and explain it in terms of a notion of development, not in the common sense language I just used.
There are tendencies away from the development that we want to go on. I mean, each of us needs to acknowledge in our own lives what that particular thing could be. The place of asceticism, all of that sort of thing, is to make us aware of kind of quintessential tendencies away from the direction towards authenticity, to God, whatever, and to bring us back, center us on God. And whether the problem is food or not, fasting can be a reminder of the fact that we need to be disciplined in our spiritual quest. So it has a really supremely beneficial role to play. Again, Ignatius of Loyola also was the first one to insist to turn the other down. Because he overdid it. And he said, I would never have to do what I did. I went too far. And it hurts my health, and that's not what I'm supposed to do.
Memory.
You mentioned Kuhn earlier, and I'm curious about how you might reconcile what he has to say, the whole idea of paradigms and anomalies, and this idea of looking at the summit of achievement. Is the great composer, the great artist, the great athlete, are they summits of human achievement, or are they sort of anomalies within the paradigm calling for a shift? Is it prophetic in that way that the rest of us can't get there because we're operating sort of in the wrong, we're not asking the right questions, we're kind of trapped in one way of thinking? Do they point the way towards the way the paradigm should shift, or are they simply...
That's a good question, but I don't know if I want to say that it's an either or, you know? I mean, does it necessarily have to be an either or?
Well, that's...
We're all aware of the fact that in some areas of development we're stuck for a while. We're stuck intellectually. John Donne, who's taught by Lonergan, has this wonderful article about waiting for insight. What do you do when you're stuck? Well, you don't give up. But sometimes you just gotta wait. And you have to pull back and wait for the right images to emerge out of the fellowship in your psyche so that the insights that you really want to come, but you can't force them for you.
Sometimes they'll never come, for most people, they'll never come to the degree that it will come for, you know, the greats in whatever field. So I'm a little stuck on why we're looking. In some ways, I see the benefit of looking at the people who are geniuses in whatever field. In some ways, I think, well, that's nice for them, but for the rest of us, that's kind of quixotic.
Okay, but what Lonergan would say, what I would say, what Ernest Becker would say, the denial of death. He never read Lonergan, but it's a book that he's a contemporary Israelite prophet, you know, a Jewish psychiatrist. And his book the main point of it, and he just hammers this home to you. And for a number of years, I read it once a year, just for spiritual reading. He just hammers it home to you that we settle for too less, for too little. We settle for less than we can really be because we're afraid of stepping forth from the embeddedness in the common sense and the meanings and of our culture and so on. And so we settle for humdrum lives. And he calls it a fear of death, but then he says it's really a fear of living, you know? And I think he's absolutely right. I really think that we are all capable of more than we want to take a chance and be, I think.
So there is a
now. Does that mean that you can be an Einstein? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean that we can be more than we give ourselves credit for, you know? And our lives can be much more profoundly enriched than they are. And it doesn't mean that we've got to be greats in anything, but it means that we can live far more richly than we do. And that's what Becker's talking about. He's not saying that we all should claim that we're better than we really are, that our potential is more. It's just that most human beings, he says, are slightly depressed.
Yeah. Well,
because they settle for too little in their life. And I think he's right.
Yeah, I would agree. I would tend to think that within the greats, there's the underlying assumption of what makes them great is that they point to something.
Right.
They point forward.
That's
they
right.
point to a way.
That's right.
And to use McCune's terms, the anomaly is a way towards the next development.
That's right.
Rather than just being an anomaly of
yeah.
lit
that's
that
right. that's
doesn't...
Right.
It's the exception that makes the rule.
That's right. And it's like Lonergan saying every obstacle is a barrier to be transcended. That's what the anomaly is. It's a barrier to be transcended. And sometimes you just got to stop and just live with it for a while, intellectually, I think. Philosophically, you reach a certain point where you just can't get your mind around something. But stop it for a while. Just leave it there. And come back to it a year later, and you'll be able to put it together. Some frequently, that can happen. This will come up in the second half of today. What we're into right now, and when I taught Becker's book a number of times in the courses, I would also come back to Lonergan here on limitation and transcendence. And the balance, so to bring the tension of limitation and transcendence into consciousness, and to live in that tension is what Lonergan means by genuineness. Right? And now what Becker is saying, and what Kierkegaard in his own way is saying as well, is that most people settle for going in this direction. Slightly, okay. The clinically depressed person is severely in the direction of limitation. But Becker's own statement is most of us are not clinically depressed; we're just slightly depressed, and it means we settle for we go a little bit too much in this direction. Kierkegaard says the same thing. Too much shut upness is Kierkegaard's language for it. But then there's the possibility of flying loose from it all and not being rooted in the limitations, and that's going too far in the other direction, shooting too far in the other direction. People who have dreams in which they're flying, you know, all the time, and flying towards the sun, Icarus, the myth of Icarus, is transcendence without limitation. It's not humble, where humble is humus, which is earth, you know, rooted in the earth, being in the earth. The balance is the hard thing. And that balance is going to shift with new integrations as we continue to live. It's going to shift. We don't stay in that balance, but rather each integration is also an operator of further development. So it's living in the balance of limitation and transcendence that genuineness resides. And I think so. In that point, the greats really call us beyond ourselves. And you know, Lonergan has the wonderful expression at the end of this book of reaching up to the mind of Aquinas. And he said, I spent years reaching up to the mind of Aquinas. I've spent years reaching up to the mind of Lonergan. I'm not there. But it's the best thing that I've ever done, you know, to stretch out towards that kind of achievement has, I hope, made me a better human being than I would have been without doing that. You know. Just to reach up to what genius calls us to in this case. It's a matter, it's always being the best that you can, you know, and that's just common sense. You don't want to, you know, it's not a matter of calling people to try to be better than their underlying manifold allows them to be, but be that, you know, and Becker's point is most of us won't even be that, because It means we have to claim some kind of individual status that is our own and own it. As this is what I've made out of my life. And, we can easily get it embedded in our cultural glories to such an extent that we never step forth. I really do strongly recommend that book. There's a dualism in the book. That's one problem. Becker divides self and body. It's a very Cartesian dualism. I think that's erroneous, but you can work your way around that. Self, in Lonergan's terms, self is body, psyche, spirit. All self. Self is the triple compound of body. So body is not outside self. Body is part of self. It's one dimension of self. It's the underlying manifold for psyche. Psyche is the underlying manifold for spirit. The human being is not a double compound or a triple compound of body, psyche, spirit. Okay, let's break for 10 minutes.